You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
We continue to cover this series that we allege that we did not care about more than any series we've ever covered around here. And Stan Van Gundy, as you may know, when he is coaching, he is an unrelenting misery. He is the face of sadness, and I am intent on making him laugh this morning. So let us begin with a tweet that comes in directed at Amin Alhassan that reads, "Amin is trash," and then there's the helpful emoji of what looks like a garbage can. Maybe it's a basket. I can't really tell, a basketball basket, but regardless, this is why Amin Alhassan is getting buried today. This is after game two of this series when Phoenix went up 2-0.
And to be honest with you, Dan, I have zero confidence the Bucks can win a game.
Really?
A game. What in their history gives us the confidence that they'll make adjustments? They don't do that. They don't do that. And the Suns are outplaying them in every facet of the game. Their role players are so bought in and invested and crisp at running their stuff. You don't ever see anybody elicit the kind of speech that Patrick Ewing gave that one kid at Georgetown about, when have you ever taken that shot? When have you ever made that shot for you to take it in a game? Everyone's playing within themselves, within the flow of the offense. And meanwhile, the Milwaukee Bucks are looking around like, we'll get into it when we get into it. I mean, even Bud's post-game comments, I don't know if you guys heard it. He was like, I'm confident those guys are going to get going. When? I'm beginning to question everything I've thought about the Milwaukee Bucks.
It's not even in there that you thought that they were the worst finals team, maybe the worst finals team.
I didn't say that. That part I didn't say. Like, I don't think I said
I think you said
I'm not calling them. I stand by some of the things I said. The Suns role players had played great all throughout the playoffs at home and on the road, and they played within themselves. And the big difference was maker from the first two games to last four games was the play of Chris Paul. And I'm not talking statistically, I'm just talking about his control of the game was waned throughout the last four games. Now, there's some people who think that Jrue Holiday is the reason for that, and I would say he played a part. I think he's injured. I don't think that wrist was good. I know what Chris Paul looks like when he's dribbling a ball, when he's trying to cross over, when he's trying to throw a pass with either hand. He wasn't capable of doing those things at the level that we're accustomed to seeing. And the level that we saw early in the playoffs.
If only we had someone here who had traded Jrue Holiday to give us some analysis of what it is that happened to Chris Paul. Stan, what did you see? I don't want to start with Chris Paul.
Listen, I'll take a lot of blame for things, but I didn't trade Jrue Holiday. So, that wasn't on me. But I'll agree. I think I didn't think their guard play was good enough. Booker was great in two of the games and bad in two of the games. Like, he wasn't very good last night at all. Turned the ball over six times, didn't shoot it well. Thought he lost his poise finally and got really frustrated in the fourth quarter. Their guard play just wasn't good enough. And I agree, Chris Paul probably wasn't fully healthy. And then I think Amin's point that was the best to me is I thought what they had gotten was great play out of their other guys. And, they had Bridges played great. They got great play out of Ayton. Crowder played great. But last night, at least, those guys didn't get a chance to play well. The ball didn't move. It was totally an isolation game for Phoenix. Chris Paul, Devin Booker, one-on-one basketball. Those other guys didn't get a chance to be involved and to make a contribution. And I understand what Amin's saying about Milwaukee. Oh, they never make adjustments in the whole thing. I don't think that's true, number one, but they may make fewer adjustments or be slower to adjust. But the positive side of that is their guys totally believe in what they do. And that if they just stay at it and go at it hard, it's going to turn around and they're going to be able to get it done. And they did. So the constant adjustments that some people get credit for, I mean, everything has a good side and a bad side. There's no perfect way to approach it. And Mike Budenholzer's done a tremendous job. I was happy for him because he's been a guy on the chopping block and, you know, not just in terms of his job security, but by the media and everything. And I've never understood it for a guy that wins as much as he does. So from a coaching standpoint, I was really happy.
We can analyze this any number of ways. I think we've mentioned Budenholzer and Chris Paul and other players before. I don't think anyone's mentioned Giannis yet. So I believe that the story is a wonderful one. When you follow the arc of the last 10 years, you've got a guy on a team. The only lottery pick is Brooke Lopez. In the age of the super team, you know, Bobby Portis was their second leading scorer most of the night last night. In the age of evolving to the three-pointer, he killed you with old-fashioned twos last night. And on the way, told you, hey, Durant is better than me. He is better basketball player. He's the best in the world. Told you, Middleton's a better closer than me. And in a season of attrition where Phoenix gets there because the Lakers are missing a guy and Denver is missing a guy and everybody, the Clippers are missing a guy. In a season of attrition, we're sitting here analyzing all of the details. And Tom, the difference in the championship is the dude started hitting free throws out of nowhere. Every free throw, he was Larry Bird last night.
Yeah, game three, he was 13 of 17 from the free throw line. And last night, 17 of 19. And when you have a guy who's basically his only weakness in the sport of basketball is the yips at the free throw line, which in the last two series, he shot 48% from the free throw line on the road. And at home, when you're not hearing the people screaming, one, two, three, four, counting that, he shot almost 80% over the last two series. And so watching Giannis last night going 17 and 19, and not just making them, but looking comfortable out there. We've been talking about the 10-second thing, but he was getting the ball, and he wasn't doing this flip. He changed his free throw routine, and he did six crisp dribbles and then right up. Very little delay time thinking about things. He just went up there and shot it. And to me, that's, if not the biggest, most critical thing, is Giannis Antetokounmpo became an amazing free throw shooter when they needed it most.
Stan, he was talking to you about this before we came on here because he has done, it's not healthy, the amount of study that Tom has done with the free throws. It's an obsessive compulsiveness that I believe is something close to mental illness, the way that he has just gotten stuck on studying this, because that is the place, Stan, is it not, where muscle memory and all the stuff these guys have learned over a lifetime, it's the time you have to think. And if doubt is somewhere in your being, it's going to make an appearance there. We saw what happened. Another way to be impressed by Giannis beyond just the 50 points is we saw what this did to Ben Simmons. Like, the stuff from the free throw line can short circuit you. That's a totally vulnerable thing.
Oh, no question about it. And what you see with Giannis and a lot of guys, and Tom could probably give us some numbers, but the eyeball test to me says, you know, his first four free throws of the night are going to set the tone. And if he gets going good, I don't just mean with him going in, but like last night, they looked good going in. He feels good. He's going to be okay most of the night. He's not a guy, though, that's going to go up and miss three of his first four and then all of a sudden make six in a row. I mean, you know, once it's not going good, he's going to struggle. It becomes a mental thing. But it was amazing to watch last night because as I was watching the game, I just kept expecting, okay, well, he's not going to make these two. I mean, the law of averages has got to catch up here somewhere. And he just kept going to the line and knocking them in. And it was the difference in the game. If he shoots his 60%, you know, and makes 12 instead of 17, we've got an entirely different game.
Stan, you coached Andre Drummond in Detroit. He shot 38%, 36%, 39%. And then your final year, he shot 60%. So something happened. Something clicked. I don't know whether we can attribute that to you or a coach or what. For the successes you've had in curing or fixing free throw yips that Giannis has had, Dwight Howard, you've coached him as well. Like, what does it come down to with these guys?
Yeah, well, Andre actually spent a summer and worked with a guy out in Southern California and changed his routine, got real confidence in it, stuck with it even when he had tough games, and made a huge improvement. So it was a lot of work and belief on his part. Never really saw it come around with Dwight or with Shaq. I mean, but listen, it starts with a mechanical thing. That's the part that people don't always, it's not all mental. I mean, look at the guys we're talking about. Dwight Howard's not a good shooter. Shaq is not a good shooter. Andre Drummond's not a good shooter. Ben Simmons is not a good shooter. Giannis is not a good shooter. I mean, is there a mental part? Absolutely. But we're not talking about Chris Middleton getting the yips at the free throw line or Steph Curry getting the yip. These guys aren't good shooters to begin with. And so there's a confidence part of it.
Coach, I agree with you on most of those names. Giannis, to me, would be the outlier because it seems hard to remember. This guy was a good free throw shooter, at least, earlier in his career. All those names we just named, none of them had ever shot higher than 65% in any year in their career from the free throw line. Giannis, starting in his second season, on four attempts, 74%. On five attempts, 72%. On 7.7 attempts per game, 77%. On 8.5 attempts per game, 76%. On 9.5 attempts per game, 72.9%. And then something happened. Last season, 63. This season, 68. And I can't call what happened. Maybe we'll have some answers to that, you know, as people do deeper dives and profiles on him. He was at one point a really good free throw shooter for a guy who's shooting that kind of volume.
No, and that's a great point. And I'm gonna say that one of the things that happens is when you miss free throws in big situations, and when it was Giannis, where it was in the World Championships with Greece. If you go back there, all of a sudden in the World Championships with Greece, when they had a chance to get in the quarterfinal, he couldn't make a free throw. Mm. And I think we've seen it before. I mean, we saw it in Orlando years ago with Nick Anderson, right? He missed those yep. two big free throws. And a guy who'd always been a good shooter and always been a good free throw shooter didn't even want to go to the free throw line anymore. I know our strategy in Miami was when he posted up Bashan Leonard, foul him the first time he posts you up and make sure it's a shooting foul. So he has to go to the line. And from then on, he's not going into the post. And it's tough to get over those things. And I'm not saying that's when it was, but I remember those World Championships. I remember him not being able to make a free throw, and he hasn't shot well at the line since then. So I'm not saying that's it, but it's a possibility. And I've seen it with other guys. Miss a couple big ones and things change for you.
It does line up, by the way. The World Championships was the summer before that season he had the first drop.
Yeah, there's a sports psychologist out in Germany that I interviewed about this, that he goes and travels around the world to meet with athletes, a lot of golfers with putting, getting the yips with putting, free throw shooters. There's lots of, I mean, pitchers who just suddenly, Rick Ankiel can't even hit the catcher, just hits the backstop every single time. I talked to him about it. I think it's fascinating because J.J. Redick has talked about it being the most mental part of the game, the free throws, is that you're standing there all by yourself. You're not moving. So suddenly your body, you're just hyper aware of every bone, every muscle in your body. And sometimes that plays a part in it, is that Giannis Antetokounmpo, when he's flying around the court, he doesn't have to think. But when he gets to the free throw line, suddenly, oh man, I really don't want to airball this. I really don't want to airball this. And DeAndre Jordan once said that he thinks about airballing it more than he does making it, is that the humiliation factor in Giannis at the World Championships, that feeling of failure is what scares him. And I do think that some of that crowd noise of the Phoenix Suns yelling like one, two, and the airballs that came with that, I think it is a lot of mental. But you hit on something, Stan, that I want to zero in on. Steph Curry, Chris Middleton, Nick Anderson's an outlier here, a guard or a wing player who had the yips. The reason why you don't see a lot of 6 foot three guys having the yips at the free throw line is because they've been weeded out of the league. You can't make it as a 6'3 player with bad free throw shooting in the league. There's like what? Bruce Bowen is probably the only one I can think of that has made it. It's just the law of Darwinism in basketball. The ones that are super tall, you can get by with that being a bad free throw shooter. So that's why you see sometimes it's just tall guys doing it. There's a myth that it's hand size. I don't know, Stan, if you believe that hand size has something to do with it. Statistically, I looked at hand length. The length of your hand has absolutely no correlation with your free throw shooting.
I told you that
it was an image of Shaq.
It's a mental illness. I told you. I looked at hand size is one of the don't look at me that way. It is one of the most wasteful journalistic exercises in the history of doing deep dive investigative
work. It was the biggest storyline in the finals. Dan yelling at Giannis at the free throw line was one of the biggest stories in the sport. So yes, pardon me for getting really interested in the science.
His hands are huge. His hands are larger than any of the faces on this Zoom, and all of the faces on this, well, two of the faces on this Zoom are rather large. Stan, what can you tell us about Giannis and what he is? This, we have not seen this since Shaq, correct? This sort of unstoppable in a bigger, stronger, faster sport, and a bigger, stronger, faster sport that is moving out to the fringes with all of the threes, a totally unstoppable force in the paint.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, if he gets to the paint, it's over. And I thought there were times in the series where in the half court, Phoenix did a really good job of just committing that they weren't going to let him in the paint. Last night, I didn't think that their players were very committed of keeping him out of the paint. He saw the biggest gaps he's seen in the entire series. Now, in transition, look, you have no chance. You're not back. You're not set. He's coming at you full speed. It was like younger LeBron stuff. You have no chance. But in the half court, I thought Phoenix had done a pretty good job for good parts of the series. Last night, I did not sense that commitment. I thought they were very committed to locking down Chris Middleton in the half court. And I thought they did a good job until he hit two big ones at the end, trapping all of his pick and rolls and things. I think they took him out. But I was surprised. People were not willing to help early, get their bodies in front of Giannis. And especially on a night where Milwaukee wasn't making any threes, I was surprised the ease he had in the half court of getting all the way to the rim.
Where does he rank on athletes you'd love to coach?
Well, I think for a lot of reasons. I think number one, he plays really hard. I think number two, he's got – you know, these are just things I like. The fact that he hasn't been a guy like in there demanding trades and looking to move on. He's sort of old school in that he wanted to lead a franchise to a championship. He's not part of the, or at least he doesn't embrace the NBA fraternity. He doesn't go out and work out with all these other guys in the summer. He's sort of old school, like, this is me and my team, and I'm competing against everybody. So I like those things, but I like even more what he brings intensity-wise to the floor. Listen, it's not just finals time. I mean, this guy's ready to play every night. I mean, you'll catch like anybody with a bad game, but I don't really recall seeing games where you're just like, well, Giannis just didn't want to play tonight. Like, he didn't put anything into it. Like, I haven't seen those games. Maybe you guys have. I have not seen a single game where I've thought Giannis wasn't into it tonight. You know, and with almost every other player, I can tell you I've seen at least a few games where he's saying, yeah, he just didn't care tonight or didn't respect who he was playing or whatever. You know you're going to get it from Giannis every night.
Coach, one of the adjustments that Bud did make was the jumbo lineup, playing Lopez, Giannis, and Bobby Portis at the same time. They did, I think, something around 30 minutes all season long. In the playoffs, they did it once for 3 minutes. But in these finals, they went to it three different times. How special was that lineup? And how hard is it as a coach to go to a combination that is not only unorthodox, but also something that you didn't try at all pretty much all year long?
Yeah, that's hard. And they did. Listen, Giannis's ability to handle the ball and make plays is the reason that you can do that. So it's three bigger guys, but one of them's essentially a guard in terms of his ability to make plays, allowed him to do it. And, you know, it was necessitated because Bud didn't want to play any of his guards off the bench. I mean, you know, they eliminated Bryn Forbes earlier in the series. They essentially eliminated Jeff Green, you know, other than a real quick bit in there.
Jeff T.
And so they were just left with Connaughton and Bobby Portis off the bench. So when you're only rotating seven guys and there's not a guard off the bench, you're going to get stuck with that lineup some. And so I think some of it, probably the first time they went to it, it was probably, what the hell? I mean, we've got to give this guy a rest. And this is the lineup we in. And then it plays pretty well. And so you have the confidence to go back to it. I'd be interested, but I doubt Bud and his staff sat down and said, you know what lineup would work really well? I don't think that's what happened. I honestly don't.
Hey everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
I mean, you got here a little late today, so you missed and the audience was deprived of some genuine heated, I don't know whether it's passion or rage that was emanating from the Stan Van Gundy bedroom, but he did not like the way that the league bends over backwards to cater to its superstars, even at the free throw line, allowing this pantomiming and allowing Giannis to get clearly more than 10 seconds. He didn't like that at all. You were righteously pissed off, Stan.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really righteously pissed off, Dan, but I did find it interesting with the controversy of how much time he took. Like, it's almost like they got a negotiated compromise. Okay, we won't give you the ball until you've gone through half of your routine. So you go ahead and take 6 or 7 seconds at the beginning, and we'll stand there and hold the ball. And then when you're ready, give us the look and we'll give you the ball. Now you can do another 6 seconds. I mean, it really, in some ways, is ridiculous. I mean, you go to the line, they give you the ball and you shoot it. That's what happens with every other player in the NBA. And because this guy can't get his shot off within 10 seconds and they don't want the controversy that goes with it, they just changed the way they officiated that situation.
One of my favorite clips from the entire playoffs, the game against the Nets, where Giannis is going to the free throw line, he's going through all his motions, and Harden is just looking around like, what are we doing? He's shrugging. He's like, and you know, Giannis gets the ball and he's going and Harden is kind of trying to step in the lane, but not trying to step in the lane. And finally he's like, what are we doing here? Are we counting at all? Cause it was a moment. It wasn't Harden complaining to the refs or trying to get a call or anything. It was a genuine frustration of what the hell are we doing? It just made me smile so much.
Yeah, if you want to learn more about the history of the free throw line violation, go listen to the episode I did about this very thing, interviewing Don Vaden, who Stan Van Gundy probably knows very well, the former director of NBA officials. They don't know what's going on. Like, former NBA referees are sitting here like, what? Why aren't we enforcing this rule against the best player in the series? Like, it's not like this is just a random player. This is the most impactful player. If he is limited in any way, this is a totally different series. So if I were the Suns or Chris Paul or James Jones, whoever it is, I'd be furious that, I mean, Eric Spoelstra, I remember talking to him about it. He's like, I mean, it is what it is, but what do you, I mean, it's not a big deal. I feel like it would be a big deal.
Well, it could have been a bigger deal, Stan. You just mentioned the way that the seeds grew from missed free throws. Imagine if, just imagine, I know there are a lot of things like this that you can analyze, but after going through last year where he gets evicted from the playoffs by the Miami Heat were the first team in the playoffs in the first game, a close first game where nothing was going right for Milwaukee, in which they called him for it. And it was late in the game, wasn't it? It was like in the last minute of a playoff game. They called him for 10 seconds and they took away the free throw. Imagine if you get from there just a total deterioration because somehow they lose the game because at the end he missed his free throws. Or to that matter, in the game before this one, he missed a bunch of free throws late. And it just happened to be that they carried him out of it with a bunch of good plays that had nothing to do with him.
The thing that always gets me, too, is even when he was going through those long routines, the most they were going to call it was once a game. Like, either call it or don't call it. And if you're going to if you don't call it, yeah, the other team's going to be frustrated with it. People like me are going to be frustrated with it. But it's just the way it is. You've decided we're going to let the guy take as long as he wants. But to call it, like, once in that game, where he does it every time, takes more than 10 seconds, that's BS. Either call it every time or just say, just be honest and say, look, we know it's a rule. We're not calling it. Like when we get to the playoffs, we don't call 3 seconds, offense or defense. There's no 3 seconds. Brooke Lopez off the ball is standing in the lane. It's one of the reasons they offensive rebound as well as they do. Giannis off the ball stands in the lane. Defenders stand, we're not going to call 3 seconds. Like, so don't pull one out late in the game and call one. And they don't. We just decided, I mean, that's the big story. Tom's a referee guy. To me, one of the big stories about refereeing is, and we all know, the referees will not even admit it, which is crazy. The game is officiated entirely differently in the playoffs than what it is in the regular season. It's not the same game. It's like they need to come out with a new rule book. Like, they hand you the rule book. Is this the regular season rule book or the playoff rule book? Because they're not the same.
Coach, you're absolutely right. Your brother brought it up on the broadcast the other day. They haven't called an offensive 3 seconds since June 11th. And they hadn't called a defensive one, I think, in the last 3 weeks. And at some point, you got to ask yourself, right, what's the risk reward of asking my guy, just stand right there. Don't cleanse, don't 2-9. Just stand right there, dare to make the call.
And even in the regular season, when they'll call it a little bit, we would tell our guys, look, I had centers for a good part of my career. And I mean, Dwight, Shaq, Andre Drummond, don't worry about it. I don't want you worried. You've got to be there to help. Don't worry about it, because at most they're calling it one time in the game. One time. They're not calling three. They're not calling four. You know, they'll call it one time. That's it. And that's worth it for us to have you be a little bit earlier on the help to stand there. I never worried about defensive 3 seconds. Never.
Yeah, there was a study about this with last 2 minute reports. A researcher found that the NBA has called out 98% of the defensive 3 second calls in the last 2 minutes of games are not called. 98%. It's an insane number. 90% of those calls are not being adjudicated in the NBA. So absolutely, you should try to game the system and plant a big man in the paint. Kyle Lowry used to do this all the time with Toronto, like the last few years, in last possession games, he would just camp out in the paint and say, they're not going to call it. That's a huge thing you can do to leverage the referees in the end of games.
But that's not just into the game with Kyle Lowry. When his guy cuts through, he stops, he stays in the lane the whole possession. And here's the other thing. They never call guards for defensive 3 seconds. It's so rare. The only guy they're ever looking at is the big guy. Kyle Lowry knows that. He's going to stand in the paint every time he goes through, and he's going to be ready to take the charge. I mean, it's one of the reasons. Listen, I mean, he's great at taking the charge, and he's willing to give up his body. Those are the main reasons. But he's also smart. Like, I don't need to be outside the lane on the weak side. They're not looking at me. I'll come whenever I want to come. I mean, it's almost like if we're going to do that, let's just get Don Nelson for years said, get rid of all these defensive rules, defensive 3 seconds and the old, just let us play whatever defense we want. And we really should, because they're not calling.
Block charges. Should we just get rid of the charge?
Well, you can't get rid of the charge. What are you saying when the ball, I mean, if the ball's coming straight at me, what do I have to do? Get out of the way? I just have to give you the basket? I mean, so somebody drives the ball, I'm not allowed to get between them and the basket? I mean, I don't think you can get rid of the charge. I really don't. I think you can change the way you call it. You know, in other words, to me, the ones I hate, guy comes down the lane, he makes the pass, and now you're there and he runs you over. Screw you. That had nothing to do with the play. You're not getting that, you know. But the guy going to the basket, I don't know what I'm supposed to do if you're telling me there's no charges in the game. I mean, I can't always get vertical and jump. I'm not there in time. And if it's on the perimeter, I'm 30 feet from the basket. I'm guarding the guy. I beat him to the spot. I can't take a charge. What are you saying? I have to let him go?
Well, it's the step into the paint and just stand there and flop, right? And it's a dangerous play on a lot of levels, right? Like, it's just to like sprint across the court, stand at a spot, and then just get barreled over. I think that might be the only way to stop Giannis at this point. Because Giannis just scored 35 points a game in the finals, 62% shooting from the floor. And it didn't seem like that was a strategy for the Suns, is to like stand there and flop when he puts his shoulder down. And I think that might have cost them a series on some level, is that DeAndre Ayton just played straight up. And a lot of times he puts his shoulder up and then just gets that space and goes in. In years past, teams are flopping and then Giannis gets in foul trouble and then he thinks twice about doing that move next time.
I think actually with Giannis, and I'm not saying this is easy to do, but I think you've got to try to keep him out of the paint. Having DeAndre Ayton drop to the dotted circle and pick him up there, and it's too late. I mean, he's coming at you with momentum and he's at the rim and he's so long and everything else. I think you've got to try. They did a good job at times on his post-ups coming to double, is just not let him hit the paint. Use that second defender, have his primary defender pick him up a little bit earlier and try to keep him out of the paint altogether. Now, that's easier said than done, and you don't have any chance to do that in transition. But I thought there were times Phoenix did a pretty good job, you know, in the half court against him, keeping him out of the paint.
I kind of wish they'd mixed up where the double came from. His height, and he's such a good passer. When he knew where the double was coming from, he was hitting those guys in the corners, on the wings, and not really having that much problem with that. But I want to shift gears a little bit to kind of what's next for both of these teams. I think, first of all, Phoenix has a huge, huge decision on their hands with Chris Paul, who's going to be a free agent this summer, or has the ability to opt out of his deal this summer. And, you know, the big thing is Chris Paul, in his capacity as the president of the Players Union, he just can't afford to give a discount in this particular scenario, because he's basically the main driver for the success they had this year. That's no disrespect to Devin Booker or Monty Williams, but this team wasn't even close to sniffing 500 before he got here for a decade. And in his first season there, they go to the finals. They go up 2-0 in the finals. If I'm Chris Paul, I want every last dollar that's available to me to come to me. I don't think I should take a discount, not only because I want to make money, but because in my capacity as president of the union, I have to set an example that we're not giving these billionaires breaks pretty much. The problem is, of course, he's 36 years old and there's a extension for DeAndre Ayton coming up this summer. There's an extension for Mikal Bridges coming up this summer. So Stan, you were once the president of basketball operations as well as coach. How do you handle a situation where you know you need this guy right now today, but in a couple of years or maybe even in a year, this might be not so much of a good decision?
Yeah, that's a really, really tough decision. But even going before that, I think one of the real challenges for Phoenix is to not over evaluate their roster in terms of where they are. And listen, I'm not an asterisk guy, any of that. Their accomplishment was great. But look, they were down 2-1 to the Lakers in the first round, and then AD plays 24 minutes the last three games. They very well could have gone out in round one. Then they get Denver without Jamal Murray and the Clippers without Kawhi Leonard. I've never seen a team have a run of having three stars out on other teams all the way through. I mean, it's obviously happened to series and even at times two series, all three series, all the way to the finals. You didn't have to play anything even resembling the best that team has to offer. And so to sit there and say, like, okay, we're the best team in the West, let's just run it back. I don't think they are. I think both LA teams are better. I think Denver is better. I think Utah's as good, at least, when we're talking playoff situations and everything. And so I think that's their first challenge. Be very proud of what you did. Don't over-evaluate your roster. You still need help to beat these other teams. And I don't know right now, to be honest, I mean, they're going to pay for it down the road. I don't think they have a choice, right? Mm-hmm. Coming off what they did and the excitement you finally, you know this better than I do because you've been down there, but the excitement they finally created down in the Valley and stuff, and you're just going to let Chris Paul go because you're worried about two or three years down the road. I mean, I don't think you can do that with your fan base. I don't think Robert Sarver, James Jones have a choice.
It might actually be worse if they let him go. It might be worse than had he never come at all.
No, that's exactly right. I think you have no choice. Now, Chris Paul may not want to be back. That's something that people, I think, are underestimating. He might want to fly the coop and go somewhere else. But if he wants to come back and you don't step up to the plate, I think that would be a disaster.
I can't believe that we removed the charge from basketball before we celebrated the actual night that Giannis had last night. A complete analysis and deconstruction of an epic and historic night that Shaq never had in the finals, that Michael Jordan never had in the finals. We've talked about a German scientist of some sort that Tom went to talk to because of his mental illness about free throws before we talked about the general excellence of Giannis Antetokounmpo carrying that team in the age of the Super team, Stan. And again, I know Amin has been saying this a lot. I thought very clearly and obviously 2 weeks ago that he was going to be one of those injuries that got someone else a break because it seemed pretty obvious he was not going to play again this season.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I thought he was out. I mean, I didn't see any way on that injury. And even when they were saying, like, well, he's going to warm up before game one, I'm like, there's no way that dude's playing in game one. And then you watch him and you're like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. But I think your point about how long or how little we've talked about Giannis, listen, it happens to all the best players. You start to take them for granted. And all you talk about is, you know, the things that they can't do or when they have bad games. I mean, you know, just you start to take for granted how dominant this guy is. Last night was incredible in terms of what he did. Now, I think part of it, I'd be interested in what Monty would say to this, but I think part of it, at least early on, was game plan. They were going to go after Chris Middleton, and they weren't going to commit as much to Giannis to open up other guys, but Giannis was unbelievable.
Can you give people a sense of who Drew Holiday is? Because I think not a household name, but then comes in and plays amazing on both ends of the floor.
Easy on both ends of the floor. He was amazing defensively. Man, Drew Holiday, sometimes I watch him and I think to myself, what were you thinking?
Yeah, he's volatile offensively, to say the least. I mean, he's very up and down offensively. I mean, he's, you know, he has some great nights as he did in game five. And then he has other nights where it's a struggle, both in terms of shot making, decision making, like Amin says, everything else. But what you know you're going to get is he's going to compete every night. And defensively, particularly when he's matched up with a really good player, he loves to take those challenges. I mean, and, you know, they were moving him around from Chris Paul to Devin Booker to, you know, and He loves that challenge.
How many other guys, Stan, how many other guys have the strength, the physical strength to do what he did specifically to Booker a handful of times, where Booker's putting down his shoulder to get some space, just dribbling, you know, near the three-point line, not even, near half court, where he's trying to get some space and Drew's not budging, and then Drew's stealing the ball and hitting a three on him. Like, how many guards in the league have the physical strength and the ability to simply not move when Devin Booker is banging into you and trying to get around you?
Yeah, almost none, because Devin Booker, I don't know if people, you know, how much you notice it because of all the other stuff he does, but he's strong as hell and he can't move Drew Holiday. Very few people, you see Drew Holiday take on big guys on a switch and they can score over the top of him, but you're not backing him down. I mean, he's strong. He's got a very, very strong base and he's built for the playoffs. I mean, it goes back to what I was talking to before, is they're going to let you play a lot more physically in the playoffs. And that's to Drew Holiday's advantage to be in there. The way Drew Holiday defended in this series, it's not legal in the regular season. It's not. Those are fouls out on the perimeter. They are. I'm not saying whether they should be or not. I like the playoff style basketball. I love watching a guy like Drew Holiday. I'm just saying in the regular season, those are fouls. It's a different rule book in the playoffs and it benefits a guy like Drew Holiday. Listen, one of the things, and this isn't a constant, this isn't referees being dishonest or cheating, but here's what I saw in the playoffs. If you got fouled on the arm on a shot, that's a foul. Okay. But the body stuff, they were going to let go, right? For the most part, they were letting that go. Well, Drew Holiday, PJ Tucker, that's a tremendous advantage for them, being able to use their physicality, where Giannis is up over the top of people and you're fouling him and Ayton can't body him. That's not his strength. So I think the Milwaukee Bucks, and give them credit for this, they're built for what we saw in the playoffs and the way the game is called. And it's called like that every year. And the league will dispute that and tell you they call it the same. You know, if you talk to Monty McCutcheon, we call the same rule book all year. And anybody who's watching the games knows that's BS.
Are you just stating that matter of factly, or do you think that's something that should change? Should they change the rule book to reflect the way it's officiated, or should they officiate it by the rules all the way through? Or are you just okay with this reality of
he's not okay with any of it? In fact, he says he's not filled with any righteous rage, and it all I hear is BS and ridiculous and ridiculous and BS, and he keeps saying he's not filled with rage, but he wants it enforced consistently. That's all he wants.
Well, I think it would be better, I mean, if we had one rule book, okay? But you've been around, Tom's been around, the whole thing.
So I'm just round.
Yes. All of us, we're all old. I'm the oldest, but we're all old. But, you know, they start the year with their points of emphasis, and in the exhibition games, it's a total joke. Every team shoots 50 free throws. There's 25 travels called each way. You can't even play the game. Then the regular season starts, and it's a little bit less than that. And as the season goes on, we get back to normal a little bit. And then the playoffs come, and we're in a whole different rule book. But we all know it. So what I think would be best is if they would officiate it consistently from the first minute of the first exhibition game to the end. But it's not really a problem, because other than for maybe rookies going through it for the first time, we all know that's the way it's going to be. And so later in the regular season, you can get away with more. And in the playoffs, even the first round's not officiated like the finals are officiated. So by the time you get to the finals, it's full on hand-to-hand combat.
Somebody rolled a grenade on the floor last night. I saw it.
There you go.
It was in the first half. You all saw it. Amin thinks
it was Bobby Portis.
I think that Monty Williams, what were you calling him? Look at me, Louie?
A little look at me, Louie, going on, right? Like the Bucks are celebrating, they're popping champagne, and then all of a sudden Monty Williams pops up and everybody's got to be quiet. Monty congratulates them and says, thank you for making me a better coach. And look, everyone loves Monty. Monty's great. I love him. But that was, look, let them have their moment. Don't make it about you and don't make a little speech. If you wanted to congratulate Giannis, you could have tugged him in the hallway. You know, there's a million different opportunities to meet and say something to the guys that just beat you. You don't have to walk into the middle of their celebration and everyone hushes as you have this little speech.
Can I get an amen? Can I get an
amen?
Can I get an amen from you, Stan Van Gundy? You would have never done that, Stan Van Gundy. Gone into the opposing locker room, first of all, you would have been an unholy misery. Nobody would have been able to get anywhere near you without getting a radioactive burst that singed their eyebrows. But you going into the other locker room and giving a speech about thank you for making me a better coach. Thank you for making us a better team. You would have never done that.
No, I gave the handshake on the floor and got criticized in 2004 by Larry Brown in the Eastern Conference Finals because he was upset that I gave him a cursory handshake. And I don't know exactly, like at the time I was like, I don't know exactly what I was supposed to do. I shook his hand. I headed in. We lost. I mean, that was what was on my mind. But let me go back, though, to Amin. I think most people would agree with me, Amin. I think it's genuine on Monty's part. I don't think Monty's thinking about that. How do I look good? I don't. I think that's Monty. Like, I look at Monty, and I know this for sure when I look at Monty Williams. That dude's a better person than I am, period.
Oh, for sure.
Like, that dude is genuinely a great person. I wish I could be Monty Williams. I'm not. I'm never going to be, but damn, that's a hell of a guy.
Yo, I'm not disagreeing with that statement at all. He's better than all of us. But all I'm saying is someone who has the empathy to realize you guys helped me to be better also has the empathy to realize that's not the arena to do that in. Like, I have 100 different opportunities to do that in private, to do that away from the cameras. I went into the middle of their celebration while Giannis has his goggles on and everyone hushed around so I could deliver that speech. Buddy, go give your speech to your team. If you want to thank people, it don't have to be in front of cameras. It don't have to be in the middle of their celebration. He could have waited later. He knew what he was doing. Let's not. Look, just because he's better than us doesn't mean he's above. There's a little Stugatz in everybody. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, let's hope not. I mean, come on. Like, that's really condemning humankind right there. Come on.
Hey, Stan, I was watching the basketball tournament TBT the other day, and they actually have the mics live on the coaches in the timeout huddles. You are the guy who is famous for saying form a wall in the middle of a Pistons huddle in 2015. How close are we to mic'd up coaches during timeouts in the NBA? And that, did that ever come across your table in negotiations with the league about like, hey, we think this could really help just bring some access to the product and watch the game with a new lens? Has that ever come across the table where you could watch Monty Williams do those speeches in the timeout huddles more?
Listen, as coaches, we've fought that stuff at every, you know, like being, you're mic'd up for every national TV game and the league's treated us pretty fairly in terms of what they put out.
You're
there.
A star. You're a star with the form of football.
That stuff's fine. But if you just had it on everybody, like, not going to be good because at times you're going to be getting on a certain player and you may have a relationship with a guy that it's understood, but the TV audience doesn't know what that is. First of all, I always think those things when they go to the coaches, I never really get anything that adds to my enjoyment of the broadcast. And as a coach, I hate it. Like, I should be able to talk to my team without, you know, everybody listening in. So from a coach,
Budenholzer looks like he loves it. He loves it. Budenholzer just has such a great time.
I don't think there's a coach that likes it. I remember David Stern going off on us in a head coaches meeting in Chicago because he asked, typical David Stern, he asked, like, you know, we're thinking of doing this for more access. What are your guys' thoughts? And, you know, a couple guys spoke out and said they didn't really like it. And he said, look, we're doing this. And you guys, I mean, and somebody said, I know who it was that said, but one of the coaches spoke out and said, why'd you ask us? Why'd you ask us? You know, and he just, no, you're going to get access. They're going to be in your locker rooms at halftime. They're going to be in your huddles, and you're going to give them access. Like those first and third quarter interviews.
Useless.
Have you ever had one Useless. Where you said, wow, that was really interesting what the guy had to say?
I've got the exact quote here. Ethan Strauss from The Athletic wrote about this. He said, should I name the name of the coach?
Well, go ahead.
He wrote about it,
but okay. Stan Van Gundy's a coward. He's protecting all his coaches. It's what he does at every turn.
No, I'm not protecting him because I was proud of him.
It's the only thing about you returning around here that I don't like, that we now have to suffer your insufferable, unrelenting protection of all coaches at every turn.
Yeah, okay, but listen, like, you want to bring something to the platform that's different. There's every guy out there in sports media is killing coaches. So we don't need another guy killing coaches. That seems to be, you know, the main things in any kind of talk about sports in the media is killing coaches. So yes, I'm the reactionary in that group.
I don't think that it's killing coaches to say that I thought that Budenholzer should have been fired last night during the celebration, and also that he very much looks like he has been someone who no longer has a job for about 2.5 months, but keeps pretending, getting dressed and going to work because he doesn't want to tell his wife that he's been unemployed. I'm not saying he's actually that person. I'm just simply saying he looks physically like that person. But what's the rest of the quote? I mean, who's the coach that was in this meeting standing up to Stern?
By the way, Bud also looks like Wednesday reverse happy hour at Applebee's. So there's that one for you. So the coach was Scott Skiles. You know, Stern communicated the importance of the TV side having access to locker rooms. Then Bulls coach Scott Skiles raised his hand and told Stern, after a preamble of no disrespect, that the locker room was his sacred space. Based on multiple coaches' retellings of this legendary league story, Stern dispatched a response with withering sarcasm. Well, let's see, the smiling commissioner began. On the one hand, we have $8 billion from our broadcast partners. And on the other hand, we have Scott Skiles.
Oh, man. Oh, Stan.
Stern then lit into him, telling Skiles in so many words and curses to shut up and that he didn't want to hear any more out of him.
Oh, my God. Stan.
I would have loved for that to just been on the street and let the matchup be Scott Skiles and David Stern.
Like, oh yeah, you took it there.
David Stern was a classic bully, always was, and he would sit there with the whole, you know, league, you know, and all of his people around him, and he could do and say whatever he wanted. You can't talk to people like that in private, and Scott Skiles, I think, would have been able to handle that confrontation pretty easily had that been out on the streets of Chicago instead of a ballroom.
It
was pretty classic David Stern, his bully act. You know, say what you want, the guy did a great job for the league, but spare me, like, what a great person he was, please.
I mean, this is so perfect. Just like the righteous indignation wasn't righteous indignation, and then he goes straight to bullshit and ridiculous. Don't want to name the coach, want to protect his anonymity, but he would have kicked the ass of the commissioner right in the street if it had come to that.
Take this outside.
And I wish
was anybody going to argue with me on that one?
Well, he tried to fight Shaq.
Yeah, he did. That's what he didn't try. He did, right? He swung, and he took a punch. So,
well, no, but here the part that's left out of that story though is, David Stern asked for coach's input. He asked for coach's input. That's the part. Yep. It wasn't like David Stern walked in the room and said, here's what we're going to do. And Scott said, this is bullshit. David Stern asked for input. Scott respectfully gave input, and David Stern attacked him. It was total, It was total bullshit and a total lack of class on David Stern's part.
Dan, it doesn't quite reach David Stern, Scott Skiles level, but I did the same thing to Stan when he was in Detroit. Stan, I can't remember what happened. It was something to do with Luke Walton and LaVar Ball and a story that had come out on ESPN. And Stan came out and just attacked ESPN and said, you know what? Maybe I'll stop doing the quarter break interviews if that's the case, if this is the kind of journalism you guys want to do. And I remember I made on the jump, I made a pie chart of Stan's salary. And I said, this amount of money comes from national TV money to the BRI, to all the teams. It was about 20%. So Stan, you can just give back $7 million right now if you don't want to ever talk to the national media again.
Yeah. And it was actually, it was a good point. But listen, the other part was, and I think I said this to you at the time, I know I said it to our beat writers. Who the hell is going to miss seeing me on a, you know, ESPN anyway? Like, I still ask the question, and I've done TV. Like, when have you had those first and third quarter interviews and said, wow, that was good? Like, you know, they're cursory questions, and you're getting cursory answers because you want to get in your huddle. And it's just,
I like it. I like it better.
I don't understand how that is stuck on all the broadcasts. That's so good.
It's just the illusion of access, and it's baked into the TV deals. Look, we can get the coach whenever we want, and here, this is some intimacy. I like better the idea of 11 years from now, somebody watching a game and like turning to his wife and saying, you know what I miss? The after first quarter interview with Stan Van Gundy. No one did him like he did. I really, Ethel, I got to tell you, they don't make him like Stan Van Gundy anymore when it comes to the post first quarter. The post first quarter interview. This has been much too serious. And it's funny that it would be serious after a series that this show famously crushed, this entire series, because I specifically got it started because I was disillusioned with how diluted the measurements of the greatness had become because of all the injuries. And I found it off-putting, the general greed of crawling to these dollars in television, no matter what. So I want to ask Stan some other questions about some other stuff. Is listening to audiobooks reading?
No, it's definitely not reading, but some people enjoy it, but it's not reading.
You don't think it can be classified as reading? Can a blind person read? Because science has stipulated that the brain functions the same when it comes to audiobooks and reading, that some of the same things are in play.
I didn't know that. So then it is reading. I mean, I trust science. That was quick. No, I trust science. So I would have said no, but if you tell me that scientists say the brain functions the same way, then yeah, it's strong. It's reading. Yep.
That gives me the opportunity here to get you into a little bit of politics and broadcasting, because you mentioned you trust science. And a couple of nights ago, in a dramatic pivot that he was applauded for, Hannity said that he now, too, trusts science. He didn't say go out and specifically get the vaccine, but he did finally say treat COVID seriously. The day that the Dow crashes because of the Delta variant, and you're assuming that lawyers are now telling Fox, hey, you guys have been really irresponsible here, and we've got to walk some of this back, I would assume. What did you make of all of that, and what do you make more specifically? Because we've talked about the divisions in this country about everything. The vaccine is politics. Everything is politics. Specifically, what it is that's happening with the media coverage that is this off to the alternate universes of giving people in their own bubbles just confirmation bias and whatever it is that they want, never mind the truth.
First of all, with Hannity, I didn't know that he had said that. This will be surprising to you, but I don't really follow Sean Hannity. but to get credit for 16 months into the pandemic saying, oh yeah, COVID's real, like, come on now. I don't think you deserve any credit for that. How about for the 16 months that you were a total idiot and probably contributed to people losing their lives and stuff because you were working against the precautions that people should take? No, zero credit for Sean Hannity. And I do think there's plenty of places you can still get truth. Yes, there's bias everywhere. There's going to be bias. The New York Times has a liberal bias. CNN has a little bit of a liberal bias. But then there is fantasy land, you know, there's fantasy land, Breitbart News and, you know, all of these Fox News for that matter, and then go even worse, OAN and places like that. So, you know, there's bias, and then there's just, we don't give a shit about reality whatsoever. Like, we're just totally detached from reality and we're creating an entire universe. Like, we can argue maybe, I don't think we should, but you might argue the side effects of a vaccine, okay? But if we're talking about Hillary Clinton running a pedophile ring out of a pizza place in Washington, D.C., we've detached from reality, okay? And there's a big difference between bias, which every human being, anybody, I've never met an unbiased person, I never will, we all have biases of many different natures, but there's a big difference between bias and total delusion.
One of my favorite things about the pizza conspiracy is that the place that they said was happening in the basement of this pizza place, they actually, these people tried to raid it and found out not only was there no child sex ring, but also there was no basement. the establishment didn't even have a basement. And that was, I remember I watched a little documentary where one of the guys who tried to raid this place was like, there's at that moment I began to question whether this was real or maybe I'd just gone a little too far.
There's a really good bit about that on the End of the Storm Q documentary from Adam McKay, a plug for a Metal Arc Media partner there. Stan, I was curious, there's seven black head coaches were hired in the most recent coaching cycle. What were your thoughts on that? And I know it's kind of a touchy subject. You were replaced by Willie Green, and we had Maria Taylor and the Rachel Nichols controversy, and the idea of like white people looking at other people of diversity and saying, not on my watch. When you see the black head coaches being hired to the NBA, 13 are now going to be head coaches in the league. What was your response to that in the past couple months with the hiring spree?
Well, I don't look at hirings as a global thing, as, you know, throughout the league. I mean, you sort of look at each one individually, and they're, everybody that's getting jobs is highly, highly qualified. So, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, that the league at least is, I think Monty Williams said this really well. You just want to get to a point where it comes down to somebody's qualifications and that they get opportunities to interview. And, you know, it's not a matter of having a quota system or how many people. It's just, does it come down to your qualifications? I mean, Jamal Mosley got the job in Orlando. The guy's been an assistant forever in this league. Like, I'm always happy for guys like that. I mean, those are the guys that I really feel happy for. Rick Carlisle changed jobs. I don't think there's anybody, I didn't see any outcry of people, you know, because Rick was white, saying Rick shouldn't have gotten the job in Indiana. I mean, Rick's highly qualified as a coach. Chauncey doesn't have a lot of time as an assistant, but he was always a very respected guy. People have heard him talk basketball. And I don't think there was any out of left field. I certainly don't think there was tokenism. And quite honestly, I don't think there ever would be in this league. I don't see an owner doing that. I think the problem is more on the other end. Are you going to give people opportunities? But I like the hires. Everybody has different reasons for who they like and don't. It's interesting with Willie Green, with me, when I was in Detroit, Willie, you know, lived up there at the time, and in the off season, right near the end of his career, he called me and like, I didn't really, I mean, you know him from playing, but I didn't know him. And he just asked if we could get together and he could talk about coaching and the whole thing. I went to breakfast with Willie in Detroit and was really, really impressed with him. And then he ended up with Steve and the whole thing. So happy for Willie. I mean, I'm happy for anybody who gets a job, and I commiserate with anybody who loses a job. You know, I mean, the one coaching firing this year that I think really got me, that I just couldn't understand at all, was Terry Stotts. I mean, like, to me, he did a great job with that roster. They're in the playoffs 8 straight years. It's not his fault they didn't build out the roster and give him more to work with. Plus, he's just a class act and a team player and the whole thing. I was surprised. But with the hirings, I thought, you know, they were all good. I mean, you know, I which one would you complain about?
Stan, when I watched Chris Paul talk at the podium last night, obviously I've got my ties to Chris Paul from college and stuff, but I feel for him on the sense of, like, he hasn't won a championship, and it probably is looking like he's not going to win a championship in his NBA career. And we talked, me and I talked to George Karl last week. He hasn't won an NBA title. And I'm curious if you think that there is a ring privilege that people who win a championship suddenly can just throw that around. Like, you don't know what you're talking about, Stan. Have you won an NBA championship before? Kendrick Perkins got into it with George Karl. They were having like a pretty normal basketball situation. And then Kendrick Perkins just straight up was like, I'm sorry, have you won a championship? I know what it takes to win a title. And I'm wondering, for someone who hasn't gotten to the mountaintop before, whether that irks you, that likes that can be used as an argumentative weapon, is that you haven't won a title. You don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, I've never felt that. I've never felt that, you know, really used against me. Now, I have said at times, like, once you win one, you're pretty much now exempt from criticism from the media. Like, once you win it, like, it'll all change on Mike Budenholzer now. Like, he's never going to be criticized again. Like, you know, like Rick Carlisle, right? Like, yep. Rick, they haven't won a playoff series in 10 years in Dallas, but nothing. I mean, nobody's going to. So Terry Stotts.
Ring privilege. That's Terry ring Stotts privilege.
They go to the Western Conference Finals. They go to the playoffs 8 straight years, and Terry gets fired. Rick. And I don't think Rick should have been questioned. Rick's a great coach, but even by the media, Rick's never going to be questioned of 10 years not winning a playoff series and not going to the playoffs in some, because he won a championship. Once you've won a championship, then to all the media, like, now you've risen up as a coach and can never be questioned again. I'm not saying no one will question you, but very few at that level where everybody in two. So Mike Budenholzer was not a good coach to most of the media until last night. And now, he's a great coach.
You know, the player version of that was Dirk. Dirk got ripped every which way about being too soft. He's not a winner. He's not this. The moment they won that ring, all of that went away, went out the window. Even when he was 80 years old, people were talking about, well, you got to respect Dirk. You still got to get Dirk the ball and all that. You know, this team, they owe it to Dirk to go for one more time and try to get him some more help there. When he couldn't, he was literally a statue that they had to wheel out onto the court, place on the three-point line, put in his hands, shoot the ball, and then wheel him back down court. Nobody criticized him because you got that ring.
Not just because
look,
of that.
I'm against players being judged by championships at both ends. I think some guys get too much credit and some guys don't get enough. Look, isn't that based on who you play with? You know, it's not like it's just you out there playing one-on-one. It's who you play with. And so because you join a super team and get a championship, now you're better than you were if you just stayed somewhere and fought. So Damian Lillard now, to get the respect at the highest level, has to force his way out of Portland and go force himself onto a team somewhere. And now you're going to think higher of him than you did. I think that's a bunch of BS. I remember listening to Dan's radio show way back when it was local in Miami years ago, and he had Robert Horry on. And Robert Horry had won these championships, and he was asking him something about comparing his career to Charles Barkley's. And Robert Horry was like, oh, I'd much rather have had Charles Barkley's career. Charles Barkley was a great player. I got to play with great players, you know, and I thought it was not only humble, but very smart. And that's the argument. Like Kendrick Perkins, really? Come on. Really? Like he's championship player because he played with Kevin. I mean, I love Kendrick Perkins as a player, and you need guys like Kendrick Perkins. But if Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen don't come there, that argument is not one Kendrick can use anymore because he wasn't leading anybody to a championship. You know, I mean, like, come on. I mean, it just, that whole comparison has never made sense to me. This guy's won that many championships and this guy's won this many championships. Yeah, well, look who they've played with. Like, to me, LeBron, the first time he went to the finals is still the most impressive thing he's done as a player in terms of elevating a team to me. I mean, he had nobody with him and they were in the finals. I mean, that to me was the most impressive. The fact that he could win a title with Dwayne and Chris Bosh in Miami. I mean, yeah, I'm impressed by that, but not like I was with the team he took to the finals in Cleveland.
Taking a totally different tone, incidentally, because we played this sound recently on Kendrick Perkins. Listen to the voice who rushes in here to defend Scott Brooks, his beloved Scott Brooks, when I continue to ask Scott Brooks questions about why Kendrick Perkins is starting. And his defense is, look at our winning record when Kendrick Perkins starts. And my rebuttal is, imagine how many more games you would win if Kendrick Perkins didn't start. So listen to the voice here that rushes in at the defense of poor little Scott Brooks.
What's the coaching mistake Scott Brooks made in the finals last year that haunts him the most?
I think I criticized myself a lot on some play calls that I could have maybe done differently, or a timeout one or two possessions earlier. It's one of those things. Do you want red wine or white wine? If the guy doesn't really know what he wants, he always picks the opposite one you're willing to offer him.
So, I want the wine that doesn't have Kendrick Perkins in the game so many minutes.
Well, that seems to be the common denominator of most people. But when you're around Kendrick, you know that he's all about winning, and his winning percentage speaks for itself. He doesn't score a lot of points, nor do we want him to. And quite frankly, he's not capable of scoring a lot of points. But he scores his points by getting us screens, Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook open for our pick and rolls or our pin down game. You can't put a number on that, but I would say, you know, he helps Kevin score, you know, 20 points of it, or 20% of his points. He's a low post defender. He's a defensive anchor, and he wins games. His winning percentage is frightening the last 5 or 6 years.
For most series, he's fine. Against Miami, that style of play, that it's less fine.
Okay, well, you know what, guys? I think I'm going to go with Scott Brooks over you two. I don't know. Just call me crazy. I'll go with Scott's knowledge of his team over Dan Le Batard and Stu Gatt.
The way he did it didn't work.
Although, I don't know. Hey, you got some good points. I have to agree with Stan on that one.
That reminded me of the whole Stern conversation. First of all, I asked him a question, and I had my own answer. I didn't care what his answer was. And at the end, you hit me, Stan, with, who do I have to listen to, my $8 billion television partner or Scott Skiles? I'm going to listen with Scott. I'm going to side with Scott Brooks, is what you say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and listen, I've always been one. I've said this several times publicly. If it doesn't work out, you can't argue that you got it right. You know, you just can't. But it also doesn't mean you don't know what you're doing. Like, we lost the year we went to the finals, we had lost a Game 5 to the Celtics. We decided late in the game we were going to absolutely trap Paul Pierce because he was so good at ending games. We did. And Big Baby Davis hit a jump shot to beat us. And they asked me, you know, at the end of the game, was it the right move? And I said, absolutely not, because my job is to get it to work out and to win games. So it was the wrong move. And you know what? If we're in the same situation in Game 6, I'm trapping Paul Pierce again. So that's where you are in coaching. And you have to realize, I've said this many times, like, we're all comfortable, I think, with being judged on the results, because that's what this business is all about. And so you don't try to make excuses for it or anything else. You can try to explain your thinking in the whole thing, but I've never had a problem with people criticizing moves like that because, hey, we're supposed to get it right and we're supposed to win. So, but it has amazed me that once you break through now, man, like, it's amazing how much in the last 12 hours Mike Budenholzer's improved as coach.
I mean,
the media now the stories are going to come out. I guarantee you the stories are going to be coming out about what makes Mike Budenholzer great and how he drove Milwaukee. And 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, a month ago, his job was on the line. He didn't know what he was doing. He doesn't make adjustments. He doesn't do this and that. And now we're going to get his leadership style and the whole thing. The media, when it comes to coaching, is totally full of shit.
There it is. Totally. There it is, the dismount. We are done there. Three media members who are full of shit, and one guy who's headed into the media who is also full of shit, Stan Van Gundy.
Full of shit.
Hey, everybody, it's Mike, and typically I record these Miller Lite spots in the studio, but I requested that I specifically record this one from my home office because I got a window, and I'm looking outside at those beautiful fishtail palms, knowing that in just a few seconds, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to crack open a can of Miller Lite, because while sitting outside by my fishtail palms is usually a good time, I like to take it up a notch and make it a Miller time. That's right, you crack that puppy open, and you don't have to think about what you're drinking for a darn second. A lot has changed over the years, including my backyard. Lots of landscaping being done right now. But the one thing that hasn't changed is the undebatable quality of Miller Lite. You don't have to choose what quality is the best. Miller Lite has great taste, and it's less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.